We all dream of seeing the world, but the realities of living somewhere outside your place of birth can be daunting, to say the least. Welcome to the Expat Money Show, helping you make the most out of your overseas career through conversations with successful expats on investing, entrepreneurship, self-improvement, and continual education, all while sharpening your financial acumen. Now please welcome your host, with over 20 years of overseas experience, Mikkel Thorup.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Mikkel Thorup, and this is the Expat Money Show. Today's guest is a former chief economist who has advised the World Bank, the United Nations, Fortune 500 corporations, and governments around the world. He is now a sought-after speaker and author of 11 books that have been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 70 weeks, sold over 2 million copies, and are translated into more than 35 languages. His newest book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, third edition, China's EHM Strategy, Ways to Stop the Global Takeover, continues his revelations and describes China's highly effective and dangerous modifications to the economic hitman strategy. Please welcome to the show, John Perkins. John, how are you?
I'm good, Mikkel. Thank you. It's good to be with you again.
Absolutely. You know, the first time we talked was probably 5 or 6 years ago. And then we had another one. You came on one of my summits, my conferences. So it's kind of interesting to talk every couple of years and get to see all the amazing work that you're up to. Now, for my listeners who have already listened to you on the program before, maybe we won't go into quite as much detail about what an EHM strategy is, but maybe just in a nutshell, in a couple of minutes, you can kind of break things down for them, for those who missed it.
Well, basically, my job was to identify countries with resources that corporations want, like oil or minerals these days, and arrange a huge loan to the country that had to be used to hire our corporations to build power plants and industrial parks and other infrastructure projects in the country that looked as though it raised the living standards of everyone, whereas in fact, actually just tended to make a few wealthy families more wealthy and big profits for our corporations. And in the end, the country couldn't repay its loans. And so we went back, usually in the guise of the IMF, to and insisted that they use a collateralized resource, that resource we wanted, the oil or minerals, to pay off the debt, essentially. Give our companies permission to go in and very cheap price develop these resources without many environmental or social regulations. You know, in that way, this economic hitman strategy has created a terrible situation in the world. It's driven by short-term profits. It's driven by ravaging the earth. And it's across the planet, it has to take responsibility for a lot of the crises we face today, such as climate change and environmental destruction and income inequality. So it's been a bad deal for the world. And at the time I was getting into it back in the 70s, I thought it was a good deal, but came to understand that the dark side of it.
Well, I've traveled quite extensively around the world for the last 20 some odd years, and it was always very surprising to me. And I never understood it until I first read your book, your first book, probably a dozen years ago. You know, you go to a place like Africa, which is just so massively wealthy in natural resources, and then you see a level of poverty there, which is just unbelievable. I sit on the board of directors for a nonprofit. And we help teen mothers in the slums of Uganda. And you look at these girls and you look at the situation and you're like, how does this ever happen? A country that has, you could throw a stick in the ground and tomorrow you have a tree that produces fruit, but still somehow people are so poverty stricken there.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got Africa's probably the wealthiest continent on the planet, resource-wise. And the poorest in terms of how it pays its people. And with the youngest population, you know, the average age in Africa, I think, is about 19 years old. That's not the death rate. That's the average age. And whereas I think in the United States, it's close to 40. And in China, it's like pretty close to 40 also.
So when you would originally go into these countries or in general in the EHM strategy, do they set up these projects in the first place, knowing that they're going to default on the loans? Is that the purpose of it? And it's made that way so that they can take a lot of these resources?
Well, it depends on the country to a certain degree. But yes, the idea is, okay, this country's got resources. And, you know, today, increasingly, there's a competition between the United States and China to get the resources that are necessary for the green economy, cobalt, copper, gold, lithium, these sorts of things. So you've identified countries that have these things that we feel we need. And then the country can't afford to develop these things on its own. It doesn't have the technology. It doesn't have the financial structures that allow it to do this. So we go in and make this offer, knowing full well that our ultimate goal is to get these resources and have our corporations in there getting the resources. And in the process, we've got other corporations that are making a lot of money off developing these infrastructure projects that the loans are used to develop. And often those infrastructure projects also serve the companies that are going to be doing the exploitation of the resources, building roads, building transportation networks, building better power systems. All of those things benefit these corporations. So while I think an awful lot of the people doing this don't understand the problems they're creating, as I did not, and in fact, it was Omar Torrijos, the head of state of Panama, the country you're in right now, that helped me understand the nefarious side of this. While a lot of the people doing it don't understand it, that is definitely part of what's called the economic hitman strategy. And the people at the top certainly do understand it.
So it really is predatory right from the very beginning with all of these things.
It's predatory and sold under the guise of helping the poor become better off, of bringing people out of poverty. And statistically, again, we can show that when you develop these infrastructure projects, the GDP, the gross domestic product, grows. So I always thought for the first large part of my career at the beginning that I was doing a good thing because I could show these projects do make the economy grow. But over time, I began to see that GDP really measures. It's a measurement of the production and sale of goods and services. It really measures how well the corporations are doing, how well the wealthy people are doing. It doesn't measure the average Joe, so to speak, the middle class or the lower classes. Kind of fall beside the way on these measurements. Not kind of, they actually do. You know, so if you take, Miguel, in the United States, we have three individuals who have as much wealth as half the population. If those three individuals made 10% on their wealth last year and half the population lost 3% and everybody else remained the same, you would show a growth of almost 4%. It would look as though the whole country had benefited when in fact only three individuals and their families had benefited and everybody else had either lost or remained the same. So that's pretty indicative. And you know, you can see that sort of thing all over the world.
Well, it's an interesting concept because from my standpoint, I'm an entrepreneur. I built a business. I provide value to the marketplace. I believe I'm pro-business. But then also, in certain instances, you see this cronyism and you see some of the things that happen underneath. And it's like, well, that's not the kind of business I'm in. That's not the kind of work that I do. It's this weird dichotomy between these two different things. Want to provide value to the marketplace and help people and build and create something. And another side where people are abusing the rules and the planet and everything that's going on.
Yeah. And it's what I call predatory capitalism. I'm all for capitalism. Capitalism means that by definition, the means of production and marketing are owned by not owned by the government, they're owned by private business. And that's certainly true in the United States for the most part and much of the world that we call capitalistic. But at least in many of these countries, like the United States, it's been turned on its head. So although the government doesn't own the business leaders, the owners of the businesses basically own the government. You know, no one gets elected to a high position without a lot of money to finance their campaigns. And that money comes from corporations and the wealthy one way or another for the most part. And so we've seen a real turnaround here. And these corporations that are doing these projects, although they may claim to be American corporations and they basically finance campaigns, many of them don't pay any taxes or very few taxes. So it's a very, very strange system we have here. And as you point out, your business is a true capitalistic business. It's a small business. You compete with other people. You don't control any governments. But the global economy today is really run by a few large businesses and their owners, people I call the corporatocracy.
So how does it work then right now? Because and I want to get into the specifics of the book and some of the things that are discussed in that. But I want to understand, as economic hitmen are still going around the world and looking for resources, but everything is now manufactured in China. So even if it is a U.S. corporation, like I don't know statistics, but I'm sure if you pick up your phone, it's probably not made in the United States. It's going to be made in Asia somewhere. So as these resources come up, why would the US and China want to compete over these things? Everything's made in China anyways, and it's all shipped over to the United States. You think that they would be partners in all of these things?
Well, and our corporations are partners. That's very interwoven, as you point out. And of course, this has only happened within the last few years since Xi Jinping became the leader of China back in 2012. Before that, China was really focused on developing its markets internally and its economy internally. After Xi became the head of state, he decided to go out into the world. And you know, that's about 10 years ago. And in those 10 years, China has been amazing at the way it's competed. Today, it is the number one investor and trading partner on every continent. And it really has taken over the world. There's an interesting map. I don't have it in front of me right now, but it shows that China is the number one trading partner with 124 countries, while in the United States, it's about 56 countries. And that's been a radical change in the last decade. So the competition is this competition between these countries' political leaders and the vision of people. So we're constantly hearing how we're competing with China and how China is trying to take over. And the Chinese people are constantly hearing about how we're surrounding them and encompassing them. That was a famous quote, you know, that Xi Jinping made very recently. But businesses, the big multinational businesses, are very much integrated in so many ways. And I'd like to say, you know, this competition between these two countries from a governmental political standpoint is a race toward disaster. We've created this death economy, an economic system that's consuming and polluting itself into extinction, that is depleting in the short run the resources it needs for the long run. Both China and the United States are doing this. And we can't continue. We know we can't continue this way. We can't keep hurting the climate the way, or changing the climate the way we are and using up these resources. So the main theme of this new book of mine is that you know, we've got to stop this race toward disaster, which revolves around the economic hitman strategy.
Well, there's the one side of thing, the green economy and polluting planet Earth. There's another side, which is also equally as scary, or at least for me, is nuclear Armageddon. I mean, I'm not a doomsday person whatsoever, but when I see a lot of the aggression that's happened going towards China and Nancy Pelosi coming into Taiwan, and now China becoming more aggressive and crossing the line there 300 times or something like that in the last 12 months or something. So you see a lot of these large superpowers, Russia, the US, and China, getting more aggressive towards each other. And these are nuclear powers that, if there is a fallout, I mean, we're all going to lose. There's going to be no winners. There's going to be no man standing on this. Now, for me, that is certainly a death economy. Like, anything that's going to perpetuate that, I think, is terrifying, to be honest.
It is. It's absolutely terrifying. And it's disgusting that our leaders can't find their way through this. And in fact, here in the United States, for the next couple of years, we can expect it to ratchet up because we're in a presidential election year. And so both the Democrats and the Republicans are going to need to seem tough on China. They think that's their, you know, find an enemy. This isn't a classic political move. Have an enemy. So who's going to be strongest against that enemy? Who's going to come up with the best plan to fight that enemy? And today, I think we can say the enemy is China. And, well, of course, Russia invading Ukraine. And now people in the United States make a very strong point of China's support of Russia, which is very minimal and tacit. And it's interesting to me that at the last global security conference meeting in Munich in December, where countries from around the world got together, we saw a very, very different point of view from the countries of the global south versus the European countries. And in fact, the global south said, you know what, the Ukraine war seems to be a white person's European war. You're putting tremendous amounts of resources in there, a lot more than you put in to help us fight COVID or to help our poor people in Africa and elsewhere. And again, I hear from these people, they don't like the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. That's not the issue. They see that as a terrible thing. War is a terrible thing because it's threatening nuclear disaster. And it's taking our attention away from what they see as the world's big problems, which are nuclear holocaust, climate change, malnutrition, disease, another pandemic coming up. These countries in Africa, Latin America, much of the Middle East and Asia, and including in our own cities in the United States, we're dealing with some very, very serious problems around poverty and inequality. And why should we be attacking each other rather than trying to find a common solution to global problems?
Well, I also think it's very interesting when you have all of these flags and signs that are support Ukraine, but then if you look at something that's happening in Yemen, which is an absolutely brutal war, and most people could never even point out Yemen on a map. They have no idea what's going on. They don't understand the history. They don't understand U.S. support of Saudi Arabia and going into Yemen. Like, they have no idea about any of these types of things. And it's just like, it's just very bizarre to me how one has captured the imagination of mainstream media and is everywhere every time you turn on the TV or the internet or anything like that. And there's something else that's happening and no one seems to care whatsoever.
Yes. And it's another thing that came out of that security meeting. The Global South said, well, how can the United States claim to stand up for legal rights and sovereignty of nations and attack and blame Russia for invading Ukraine when the United States illegally went to war in Afghanistan, in Iraq? Every country voted against our entering that war. The United Nations did not support it. The same thing in Vietnam. The United States has a long history of this. So the accusation is made, how can you then claim to follow the rule of law, basically? We've got a lot of big issues that we're dealing with here. And it's an interesting thing in a way that the invasion of Ukraine has brought a lot of this to the surface, Miguel. And, you know, I think for much of the world, the important thing here is to stop that war somehow, reach a negotiated agreement somehow that takes into account the whole world, perhaps, you know, not just Crimea and Ukraine, but how do we take into account the incredible damage and the law and the threat to life that this war is causing? And as you mentioned, the possibility of nuclear, and Putin's talking about using limited nuclear weapons, but
strategic nuclear weapons. And when you actually do any research on it and you see the megatons, strategic, they're like 10 times larger than what was dropped in Japan in World War II. And it's like, that's pretty scary. And then anything that would happen, there would be a repercussion for that, not just on that site, but from the other side. So it really is a chain reaction. And actually, I've heard statistics that are saying that we are closer to nuclear war now than we have been in any time since Cuba and the Cold War and JFK. Like, that's really terrifying. And I'm a young guy. I'm just turned 40 and I have two small children at home, two young kids. And the thought of these types of things in the future is just unbelievable.
It is. It is unbelievable. And it's something that we all need to come together to try to stop and to recognize that the problem is not any particular country. The problem is the attitude of them versus us, the attitude of ripping up the earth, of who's going to take over the resources of this country or that country, them versus us. And, you know, I often think, Mikhail, what if there were a bunch of UFOs hovering above us, a whole fleet, and they're threatening to attack us? Hopefully they would be friendly, but let's assume they're not. Let's assume they're posing a real threat. What would China and the United States and India and Panama and every other country do?
They'd all band together, I suppose.
Yeah, historically, that's proven. You know, look at Japan and the United States, and Germany and the United States were terrible enemies during World War II, but very soon afterwards joined forces to fight a common enemy, which to them then was the Soviet Union, was communism. We have a whole, human history is full of enemies coming together to fight a common enemy. Well, let's assume that the aliens then, we are the aliens. Let's look at ourselves, not humans, but our attitude that we are apart from, not a part of nature, that we are supreme, human supremacy. You know, white supremacy is a terrible thing, but human supremacy is a really terrible thing, that we can exhaust the limits of this planet any way we want. So we are the aliens. Our attitude is the aliens. And if we can understand that we've alienated ourselves from our own planet, then maybe we have the opportunity to come together. And China and the United States and anybody else can disagree on many things. We can fault them for what they do with the Uyghurs and other minorities. They can fault us with what we do with immigrants and our own minorities and people in prisons. And we can fault them for their aggression toward Taiwan and Hong Kong and Tibet. And they can fault us for our aggression toward Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and elsewhere. We can disagree on a lot of things, but let's agree that we must stop alienating ourselves from our planet. We must come together to recognize that we've got to create what's called a life economy, a regenerative economic system that pays people to clean up pollution, to rejuvenate destroyed environments, recycle and develop technologies and systems and products that don't ravage the earth, that support long-term life on this planet.
Well, I've been traveling for 23 years straight now, and I've been to 110 countries, and I've been to China 20 times. I've been to North Korea, Iran, all these countries that are supposedly evil. I can tell you from my experience that humans are inherently the same. We all want the same things. We want a roof over our head. We want to protect our family. We want to be loved. We want a full belly. I mean, humans are the same, and I don't care tall, short, fat, skinny, gay, straight, doesn't matter to me. Black, white, people are the same. 99.999999% of the people were exactly the same. I do think that there is a very small subset of sociopaths who have taken control in certain things. And I think that that is what's happening with this death economy. I think that inherently people are good and we are the same and it doesn't matter where we come from. And I would rather see people recognize those similarities than always this divisiveness of how we're different than everybody else and this person's wrong. And I see more divisiveness now in the last 3 years than I've ever seen before in my life and in all of my years of traveling. And it's sad to see because I live in new countries and my business is helping people move to a new country and adapt to a new country and learn the language and the culture and the history and the food and everything like this. And so for that, you do need to see similarities. You need to see common ground with people.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, these are the most divisive times on a global basis. You know, I'm a lot older than you, and I was in college during and then out of college. And why I joined the Peace Corps was because of the Vietnam War. And there was tremendous divisiveness, but it was quite limited to, well, there was the race issues in the United States and the Vietnam issue. And the Vietnam issue impacted people around the world as Ukraine is doing. But in those days, we didn't have the massive threat that we have today. There was the fear of nuclear Holocaust, but there was no such thing as a discussion around climate change or species extinction or destruction of environments. Well, I shouldn't say there was no such thing. There was a very, very small group of scientists that were looking at this. But today we've gone to a new era of divisiveness in a situation where we are truly, truly threatening life on this planet as we know it in so many different ways. So many different ways. Hopefully we're being shaken away. And I do see people around the world having discussions like the one we're having. I travel a great deal also, and just came back from Latin America. I was in Central America. I was next door to you, you know, in Costa Rica.
Okay.
And also Guatemala and the Bahamas and other places. And I'm headed to Europe soon. And, you know, everywhere I go, I find that people are waking up to the fact that we've got to change. And of course, the pandemic taught us that not only we can change, but we can enjoy the change. We can learn from the change. You know, how many people did something they'd always wanted to do, but never thought they had time to do, but the pandemic gave them time to write a book, read a book, learn how to play a musical instrument, whatever. We learn that we can change and we can even enjoy the change. And I think that's an important lesson. Now we've got to apply this to our whole socio-governmental economic systems.
Super exciting news. We just released our first in a series of expat guidebooks. These are in-depth country guides on how to move to another country. And the first one released is Expat's Guide on Moving to Mexico. It took us over 2 years to compile all the research and write this book on Mexico. And coming in at 475 pages, you can really see how much work has gone into this. It's a complete guide on everything you need to know if you want to move to Mexico, including where to live, immigration, taxes, lifestyle, buying property, how to get a driver's license, and a million other things you would never think you need the answers to. You can find the book directly on Amazon by searching for Expat's Guide on Moving to Mexico, or go to expatguidebooks.com, which will take you to our online shop where you will find the book. Go to expatguidebooks.com, that's expatguidebooks.com. Yeah, the last 3 years have been very interesting. I mean, as I said before, I'm a young guy. I don't pretend to have everything figured out by any means, but I've just never seen any time in my short life where it has been anything like the last 2.5 years. And I'm a big study and proponent for history, and I have learned and read, and there are moments in history which I think stand out for long periods of time. And I think what we're going through today and have been for the last 2.5, 3 years, I think this will go down in the history books. And there are a lot of changes happening. I am absolutely a freedom fighter. I disagree wholeheartedly with the lockdowns that have happened over the last 3 years. But at the same time, I think that you're right that people have had to adapt, and things that were completely out of their control. Some people got very depressed and drank too much and did drugs, and we've seen massive amounts of suicides. And other people came out the other end a lot stronger and learned new skills and refocused on their lives and reconnected with family. So I'm very much an optimistic person and a positive glass full, half full type of person. But the last couple of years has been pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, Mikhail, I think history, one of the other things that history teaches us is that perception molds reality. And if we have a perception that there isn't any hope, then there isn't any hope.
Agreed.
If we have a perception that we can turn things around, then we have a very good possibility of turning things around. If you look at history, I'm often taken by how in 1773, 1774, in America, nobody believed that a bunch of farmers and hunters could defeat the most powerful army in the world, the British Army. Nobody believed it. And then George Washington stood up before the Continental Congress, and he remembered how 20 years earlier, about the time of the French and Indian War, the largest British army on the American continent, under what was considered its best general, General Braddock, was roundly defeated by a much smaller group of Indians and French at the Battle of the Monongahela. And he said, you know, the British are not invincible. All we got to do is hide behind trees. Change the perception. Not invincible. I've seen them beaten. I was there. Washington was there at that battle. And Braddock was killed. Most of his officers, Washington being one of the exceptions, were killed. And it's about perception. And over and over and over again, we see this. You know, you're in the country of Panama. I remember in the early 70s, there was a perception that there was no way in hell that the United States was going to turn the Panama Canal over to Panamanian control. And if they did, the canal would fail. That was a perception. And Ronald Reagan promoted that perception as he was running for president in the initial years of his run for the presidency. And yet that perception changed. And Jimmy Carter and Omar Torrijos negotiated a canal treaty. And in fact, the canal has been run more efficiently since the Panamanians have been running it than it ever did under the American management. You know, it was managed pretty well under the Americans, but it's done even better under the Panamanians. Fewer breakdowns, more efficient, and so on and so forth. So, you know, these perceptions, we've got to change them. And today, I often hear there's a perception that China and the United States can never get along. I just was speaking at an event in Costa Rica about this, and one person says, there's no way that China and the United States can get along. There's too many differences. There's too much antagonism. And it's like, wait, the probability is they can't get along. I said, well, yes, but you know, history is written by those who defy probability. Probability was that the Americans could never defeat the British, but they did. And time and time, and probability was that the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, could never defeat the American army, but they did. And history is written by those who defy probability. I think we're at one of those times now. Maybe the probability is high that the Chinese and the Americans, the China's government and the American government can't get along, but let's turn that around.
Well, it's interesting because, as my audience knows, my wife is from mainland China. She's born in mainland China, raised in mainland China. She is Chinese through and through and through. She's not an ABC, American-born Chinese or something like this. And I have been a big fan of Jim Rogers for many, many years. And he told in his writing 20 some odd years ago that China would be an economic superpower. And I listened to that and I studied the culture and the language. And I speak a good amount of Chinese and really tried to understand and ended up marrying a woman from there. And I've had clients or random people on the internet or subscribers say to me, you're a self-proclaimed freedom fighter. You're a libertarian. How can you marry someone from China? My response is very simple. We have to separate a country's government from the people. It's like you can't blame American people for the stuff that's happening in Syria right now or what happened in Iraq and in some of our other examples. Governments are one thing and the people are something else. Exactly the same in China. 1.4 billion people there. They're not evil. I mean, they're some of the most warm, caring, and considerate people who will happily take you in. I have my mother and father-in-law staying with us right now. They're the sweetest people in the whole wide world. And they're from China. So we really have to try to understand that when we say, oh, China's doing this or China's doing that. Okay, that is a very small subset of the government, which is, you know, minuscule in comparison to the overall populace of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. When we look at history, it's the problems, the wars, and all of this have been instituted by a few sick leaders, if you want to call it that, or self-serving, narcissistic, maybe sociopathic. But, you know, they are driven by whatever is defined at that particular point in history as being success. So today, what we define as success is money and profits. So our corporate leaders and those who determine essentially who's going to run our governments are driven by this short-term profit motive. And that's the perception. The perception is that to be successful in business or as a human being, you've got to have materialistic gain, short-term profits or more stuff than somebody else. You know, if you don't buy this shirt from me, Miguel, you're not going to ever be successful as a podcaster. You're going to have to wear a shirt like this, you know. That whole perception, you know, marketing is all based on perception, as is politics, as is just about everything in the world of humans. But if we can turn that perception around and say, hey, success is about creating a world that that your children and their children are going to want to inherit, that a long-term view, if we can make that be the guiding story of success, then the sociopaths and the narcissists are going to buy into that because what they want to do is be successful in whatever the perceived definition of success at the time. It's sometimes, you know, it's been spread civilization or to spread Catholicism or to spread Islam or whatever it's been. But today it's short-term profits maximization.
Well, that's why I love Latin America. I really find that there's very little keeping up with the Joneses type of materialistic thing here. It's very family orientated. People want to go out to the beach on the weekend. They're at the park. They do birthday parties. You see 3-4 generations all together. It's very family. People don't care as much about the materialistic things. They want to have the experiences. And I definitely resonate with that. You know, my whole life has been not acquiring stuff, but acquiring experiences. Every new country I go to was a new experience, a new learning opportunity. So I am very rich in memories and experiences. I think that this is a beautiful way to live life. Now, I don't try to tell anybody on how they should live or how they should not live, but I do suggest to anybody who's listening, who is looking for something which is more connection with nature, being outdoors, nice weather, more family oriented, Latin America is certainly a good option for this.
Yeah, you know that famous saying, it's in Spanish, it's they'll say, you in the United States live to work, we here work to live. And I would be living in Latin America if it weren't for the fact that I've got my partner. We have a number of children and grandchildren that are in the area where we do live, but she says here. As you probably know, I spend 2 or 3 months every year in Latin America.
Well, I remember the one time you were doing a trip in Guatemala that you invited me to come with you on. It was like shamans and sounded amazing. I had something going on at the time, but I think that is just so incredible.
You have another chance. I do it every year.
And do you really? That's amazing.
Just posted on my website today the dates for next year, which is January 18th to the, I can't remember, 25th or something. But it's on my website, johnperkins.org. So join me in Guatemala. It's a phenomenal trip, where we hang out with the shamans. We go to the sacred sites of Tikal. And you know, the shamans have this magnificent memory, a story to tell us of how back by the year 900 AD, they had essentially done to their climate what we're doing to the global climate. They had cut the trees, drained the swamps in order to build these magnificent pyramids and temples that are all over the Yucatan of Mexico and the Petén of Guatemala. In the process, they changed the climate and they destroyed their way of life. They, you know, cities that had been peaceful went to war with each other to take each other's resources. And then eventually the people just left and went back up into the mountains or deep into the jungle, and the jungles took over. So from 900 to 1850, more or less, nobody knew those cities were there. That nature had taken over. They looked like mountains covered with trees. So they have this incredible story to tell us, which is theirs is a harbinger. Their story is a harbinger of what we're facing today. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too, this, you've got that attitude of enjoying life in Latin America. At the same time, as a whole, Latin America, 25% of its energy comes from renewable resources, where for the rest of the world, it's something like 12%. Some countries like Costa Rica, just about 100% of their energy, of their electricity, comes from renewable resources. And throughout the continent, you know, they've made tremendous progress in that regard.
Well, here in Panama, and I know you used to have your own power plant. I know your backstory from our other conversations, but although I think it's like 19 out of, don't quote me on the exact numbers, but 19 out of 22 power plants here in Panama, or 19 out of 23, are hydroelectric. So actually, we get it from renewable sources, and it's very not as dependent as a lot of other nations who are burning natural gas or oil or coal, which we're seeing a huge resurgence of for electricity at the moment. So it is on the right track, I would say, in a lot of these cases.
I was also fascinated when I had an office in Panama in the 70s. And spent a lot of time there. And so many people high up in the government were women. And people back in the United States were talking about, well, it's a machismo. It's quite the opposite. You know, Latin America took a very strong leadership role. It's had a number of, throughout the continent, a number of women presidents and women in very high positions long before the United States. Of course, the United States still hasn't had a woman president. But again, these perceptions are damaging. We have these perceptions. A lot of the people that I was working with at high levels of the Panamanian government were women, and there weren't any at that time in the United States in equal positions. There are today, increasingly, but Latin America has been a leader in many ways that would surprise a lot of people.
Well, let's circle back a little bit to what China is doing. And it kind of leads into Latin America, because China has very strong ties here now in many countries in Latin America. I know a lot of Americans and Canadians are quite scared about this. They think that because China has ports or helping to build infrastructure things here, that now the country is going to turn into a communist country. What is your perspective of the connections between Latin America and China, or China and Latin America?
Well, China's the largest, you know, in 2020, by 2020, China had become the largest trading partner in Brazil, Chile, Mexico, Peru, Uruguay, and second largest in most of the rest of the continent. And it was among the top sources of foreign direct investment throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. I think that's continued to grow. It's also made a lot of mistakes. You know, it's built some bad projects, some dams that are failing in places like Ecuador, mines that are threatening to cause a lot of pollution. So there's a dark side to China's involvement in Latin America. But the fact of the matter is, it offers a model which is extremely attractive to Latin American leaders as well as African leaders. It's a model of having had about 10% economic growth a year for 30 years. And it's brought more than 800 million people out of dire poverty, according to the World Bank, more than the rest of the world combined. And Bloomberg recently had a statistic that in the last 7 years, China has reduced carbon pollution more than the United States has in 30 years. That's a statistic that surprises a lot of Americans. Despite the fact that it's continuing to build some coal-fired plants, it's managed to reduce carbon pollution significantly. And so if you're the leader of a Latin American country, you might well say, well, I don't really want to have the kind of government that China has. I don't want to necessarily have the kind of system it has, but I do want to be part of that economic model. And the United States, when I was an economic hitman, and I write about this, we continue to, every time we give loans, we get involved with countries, we institute what are called neoliberal economic policies. And these include privatizing government businesses like the utility companies, water and sewage systems, and electrical companies, and reducing government regulations, dropping taxes on the rich, and dropping social services and wages on everybody else, basically. What's called trickle-down economics, it leads to that. And imposing these things on governments that take our loans and that become involved with us. China, on the other hand, makes a big point of it did not grow its economy through neoliberal politics, but economics, and it's not going to impose those on anyone else. It is very careful not to impose things on other countries, with some exceptions. Like, it does ask countries that it's involved in to support it and not recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation. So there's the story and there's the story behind the story. But overall, leaders of countries in Latin America, Africa, and many other places have to look at the Chinese model as being a lot more successful than the American model. They also, I happen to be in Guatemala waiting for people to fly in to join my group right during this huge air transportation debacle in the United States when all this shut down because of the computer failure. And my Guatemalan friends would kind of laugh and say, well, it's just another sign that the United States is the world's biggest banana republic without any bananas. The world looks at us now as a failed democracy in many respects. They say, you know, you can't seem to get anything done, that your two-party system doesn't seem to be working very well. So, you know, they look to China and say, there's advantages here. There's a lot of advantages. And we'll see where all that goes ultimately. I think U.S. Vice President right now is in Africa trying to mend some very harmed relationships on that continent that the U.S. Has managed to piss off a lot of people there, a lot of governments. She's trying to mend that. So I think in a way, the U.S. is beginning to wake up to the fact that it's being left in the dust by China. But we'll see what happens next.
Well, we'll definitely see what happens next. But I do think that you really brought up an important point there. When you look at the two systems of the EHM and going into other countries here in Latin America, okay, I've traveled pretty extensively through Africa. I've probably been to 15 or 20 countries there, but I certainly know Latin America a lot better considering I live here on the ground and, you know, I can see the Panama Canal just out my window up on this side. So it is very interesting that China will come in, do these types of projects, become the largest trading partner, but are not looking to interfere or say, you have to take our culture with it. You have to take our worldview or our perspective at the same time. They'll go in, they'll make their deals, but then they step back. Like, they're not trying to spread their way of life anywhere. And I think that so many Americans and Canadians who come to these other countries and see the influence from China kind of assume that it's going to be the same way that the US has spread their worldview to everybody else. And I've just not seen it. I've not seen this type of behavior anywhere. And I would like to think that I have a special perspective in that I've traveled a lot. I live here and my wife is from China. So we actually look for Chinese cultural things, and it's not being rammed down people's throat by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. And that's true all over the world. And the U.S. has that reputation. The other side of that is the U.S. has a reputation of actually being involved in coups and assassinations of leaders that we don't like. And, you know, Allende in Chile, we've admitted to that. Henry Kissinger admitted to our involvement there. Arbenz in Guatemala, and more recently, Zelaya in Honduras. And in the past, Mossadegh in Iran. And we have this history, and we also have a history of building military bases everywhere, you know, having a military presence in way over 100 countries. China just doesn't have that history or that reputation, except in this very tight region that it claims to be part of it, and that includes Taiwan and Hong Kong, unfortunately, in the South China Sea. But it's never... Historically, China has never gone very far militarily. It's gone very far in trade and commerce, at the old Silk Road, and now the new Silk Road. So where the United States might go into Panama or Nigeria or some other country and say, hey, we're going to strike a trade deal with you so that you'll have favored relationships with the United States. You'll have a good bilateral trading agreement with the United States. And China, on the other hand, goes in and says, hey, we're going to make you part of the new Silk Road. So you'll have good trading opportunities everywhere. We'll build ports. So China today in Panama controls a commercial port on both sides of the Panama Canal. China controls them. But they're saying, you know, we're helping Panama trade with Africa and India, and as well as China. Whereas the United States tended to say, you're going to have a good bilateral trade agreement with us in the United States. So this is another very, very attractive aspect of China. And it goes historically back to the Silk Road, which was a trading route. It wasn't a military route. It was a trade.
And as for your point about having two of the ports here, I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's five major ports here and China has two of them. So it's not that China owns Panama by any stretch of the imagination, but they do have a vested interest in seeing stability in Panama. And the US also has a vested interest in seeing Panama very stable and secure. I actually like that from both sides, they want to see the country get along and things be peaceful here. And it is a beautiful and peaceful place.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if we could take that situation of wanting stability and expand it to every country in the world to say it's to the interest of both China and the United States. In this new book, which is the third in the Economic Hitman trilogy, and this one's really devoted to China's economic hitman strategy and how the United States and China, both of these countries, our strategies are destroying life as we know it on this planet. They're really threatening the future of your children and my grandchild. So that's the challenge. And as you pointed out, Panama is a great example of a place where it serves both countries' interests to maintain stability and for both countries to get along. And yeah, so two ports in the out of five. So there's an interrelationship there. And how do we spread that to the rest of the world? That's the real question. How do we come to a point where we can look at stability around the world will serve all of our best interests?
Yeah. This divisiveness that we were discussing before is just unbelievable. And, you know, I'm very venomously opposed to war. I mean, I lived in the Middle East for 8 years. I've traveled through these regions. I've seen what has happened. I really do not want to see any more. I don't like what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. I think it's a different story than what is broadcasted on mainstream media, but I'm against that. I'm against all of the wars that are happening everywhere in the world. And I would like to see a lot more stability. And as you described, a life economy. Let's try to, you know, figure things out. And I don't mean this to be kumbaya or something, but it's like, we do have to figure out how to get along. Like, I'm not expecting every single cultural difference to be resolved or problems or history, everything like that. But we definitely need to take a step back and look at the damage that is being done to the planet and damage that is being done to one another and these wars and this aggression. It's disgusting, as you said earlier.
And you know, Miguel, I've given you the Spanish pronunciation. Miguel, I think we've been moving in that direction. The idea of conscious capitalism, of Green New Deals, of globalization in a way, and also being as local as possible. I think that's important to understand. The more Panama can do locally as far as growing food and taking care of itself and using hydroelectric power, as you said, not being dependent on foreign oil, the more we can do locally, great. But we've got to recognize that there's an awful lot in our world that's globalized. The fact we're having this conversation, so we've been moving in this direction, I think, of bringing these two together, emphasizing the local and at the same time recognizing that we are global. The pandemic set us back a little bit, and it also taught us some good lessons about change. This war in Ukraine is setting us back again. A country like the United States is stuck back from its idea of cutting back on fossil fuels and actually increasing fossil fuels as part of this effort. But I want to think of those as blips, that we've been on a trajectory where we are changing consciousness. We're recognizing that we've got to change and that we can do it in a way that will not cause a lot of suffering. In fact, will cause improvement. The idea of the life economy, you pay people. We're talking about growth. You know, people say, we got to stop growth. No, no, no. We've got to stop the kind of growth we've been accustomed to that ravages the earth to make that growth happen. But we need to grow in ways that help starving people feed themselves. We need to grow in ways to pay people to clean up pollution, to mine the plastic that's in the ocean, and to regenerate destroyed coral reefs, as one example, and on and on. So there's tremendous opportunities here. And I think that we're living at a time of challenges, of crises, but also of amazing opportunities to reach a new level of what it means to be human beings, being human on this planet.
Well, my last little point here, and I'm in full agreement with what you just said, is really down here in Latin America, it's amazing when you can learn from the local farmers and see the practices that they do, opposed to, you know, just row crops, just hectare and hectare and hectare of row crops that are all sprayed with chemicals, which are destroying the earth. You know, where you look at US or Canadian style feedlots, where the earth just ends up becoming dead. And I took a group of clients down to Uruguay, and you see the cattle there. They've got millions upon millions of cattle, and they're free, and they're going up and down hills and eating 2,000 different types of clover. And the meat is excellent for you and has rich in omega-3 fatty acids and all of these types of things. So there are alternatives for our food sources, and it doesn't have to be destroying and polluting the earth. You know, I don't want to eat food like that. We try to eat absolutely as much organic as possible. We eat as local as possible. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but we even bring in our meat from on the airplane with us, and we declare it. We brought in some meat from Brazil because I wanted to have like really high quality meat. I mean, that's not local, but definitely I'm willing to pay more to make sure that I have food, which is going to be good and nourish my family. And that kind of goes to your point of companies that are doing things that are going to rejuvenate should be rewarded. And I think a lot of people see those types of things.
Yeah. One of the things that came out of the pandemic for me is that my partner, the woman I've been with for many years, has been vegetarian most of her life. We didn't go to restaurants during the pandemic. She cooked, and she's an excellent cook, but it was all vegetarian. I became a vegetarian. And I feel a lot better. And I love it, you know, philosophically, because I think that it's good for the planet. But so for me, that was a personal thing. I'd always, no. Why would anybody be a vegetarian? We were born carnivores. We were born omnivores. We need to. But I had this experience during the pandemic that turned me around in that way. And I'm not trying to pass any judgment on people. I'm just saying that for me, it worked out really well. That was one of the changes that I made in my life. And I'm very happy that I did.
Well, I'm very happy for you, John. On this one, we're definitely going to disagree. I'm a carnivore. I like my beef. I want it really high quality. I want it free range. I want it having a nice life and absolutely show respect to the animal. And we eat the insides of the animal and all the stuff that other people, as I said, my wife is from China, so we eat liver and heart and everything like that in the intestines. So I think that showing respect to the animal is very, very good, but I will continue to eat my beef. As amazing. John, fantastic conversation. The new book, Economic Hitman, third edition, 12 explosive new chapters, China's EHM strategy, ways to stop the global takeover. Thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. If people want to reach out to you, if they want to learn more about your work, where can we send them?
JohnPerkins.org. And put your email address in the little subscribe box. So once a month, you'll get a newsletter from me that also says where I'm speaking. So I'm going to be speaking in Europe. I'm speaking a lot in Latin America, and I'd love to meet some of your audiences. So please sign up. Go to JohnPerkins.org. The newsletter, you won't be overwhelmed with it, but you will receive some information which might be helpful to you.
Well, I've been on your newsletter for years and years, and actually an interesting thing is you told us, your subscribers, that you would be putting out a new book, and you actually put forth a couple of different cover designs for the book, and we got to vote on them. Now, I can't remember if the cover of the book that made it on was the one that I voted on or not, but I do really like the cover very much. So it's fun things like that that we get to participate in as well.
Yeah, it's the one that won the most votes.
Yeah, I just don't know if it was the one that I voted for, because you had a couple of really cool ones. I'll have to go back and see. Nice one. John, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work. And yes, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Mikhail. Keep up your great work. I so appreciate what you do. Thank you.
For those interested in moving to another country, I highly recommend learning the local language before you arrive. After traveling for the last 23 years straight, I have seen many people fall into the expat bubble trap. This is where you move to a new country and you only talk to people from the USA or Canada, and you are unable to make local friends. The best way to combat this is by having an understanding of the local language. And the best program I have ever seen for this is StoryLearningCourses.com. These are the programs I use to go from very crummy language skills to fluent in no time flat. The courses are fun and easy to understand, and most importantly, really work. No matter where you are in your language learning abilities, go to storylearningcourses.com. That's storylearningcourses.com to learn more.
This episode may be over, but your journey to greatness continues by visiting our webpage and signing up for our newsletter. For convenient access to new episodes, show notes, and other crucial resources, visit expatmoneyshow.com. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Expat Money Show. Safe travels!